This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
My name is Stan Rosenfeld. The following presentations are going to talk about resources for prostate cancer patients that you may or may not know about, and some more details about those that you might already know about. The presentations will be made, I can look down here. Presentation will be made by members of the Patient Services Committee and advocates. Next slide. All right, so the Patient Services Committee was formed 27 years ago with the intent of making the journey of prostate cancer patients at UCSF a little less stressful and a bit more knowledgeable. I remember the day way back when that Peter Carroll told me that my mission as chair of the committee was to keep him, Dr. Peter Carroll, on the straight and narrow. I remember that quote exactly, keep him on the straight and narrow. I've been told that we, the Patient Service Committee, has been doing that fairly successfully. I am now the chair emeritus, and Leszek Izdebski and Bruce Zweig are co-chairs. And now, Jim White discussing prostate cancer waypoints. Jim?
Hello, I'm really impressed with all of us patients who showed up today for this and came in out of the sunshine. I'm here to talk to you about remind you about the prostate cancer waypoints on the urology site at UCSF.com. Next slide, or click once at least. Let me see if I can click. Yeah. The waypoints portray prostate cancer as a journey. A lot of the credit for the waypoints goes to Nathan Roundy, who's sitting up here at the table and present in a minute. He conceived the idea of presenting prostate cancer as a journey with these waypoints. Worked with UCSF doctors and staff to flesh out the idea and turn it into what is now many web pages with lots of detailed information. And there's links there to where the waypoints are. The waypoints start with background on prostate cancer and then move through a series of decisions, beginning with getting tested, simple PSA blood tests. Most men won't get past that step, but about 1 in 8 will. And so that's why it's so important. Testing and early diagnosis is a key here, and as you can see on the slide, the waypoints then cover later decisions if you are diagnosed with the disease. The waypoints are an easy-to-use educational tool. You can jump in at any point in the waypoints and learn about your particular phase of your disease. I've been on my own prostate cancer journey for about almost 10 years now, and I frequently get asked by friends and family and acquaintances about prostate cancer, people who now have their own diagnosis and want to learn something. I point them to the waypoints as a user-friendly but comprehensive education about prostate cancer and treatments. So use the waypoints yourself to educate yourself and refer others to them.
Hello, everybody. It's really a great pleasure to be here. I'm Beverly Nicholson, and I'm a support group leader from Sacramento, California. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge all the other support group leaders that are here in the room. I know there are a number of you, either now or in the past. Would you raise your hand if you've been a support group facilitator? And how about members of support groups? Raise your hands. Okay, we have quite a few in the room, the record will show, so that is wonderful. Well, today I have the pleasure of talking to you about why you might want to consider being in a support group. I have to say that, how did I get into this? Well, in 1992, I was an oncology nurse working at UC Davis Cancer Center. And at that time, you know, men were getting diagnosed at an earlier point because of PSA testing. And Dr. Devere White, who was the chair of the urology department at that time, thought there was a need, and he was right. He knew there were more choices for men, and they needed to have a place to talk about all these options and the confusion that they might have as a result. So I'm very pleased to say I was a very, very young oncology nurse in 1992. Don't do the math, that's okay. But our group has evolved into the Greater Sacramento Prostate Cancer Support Group, and we continue to this day. So the main point I need to make is that you really do not have to face cancer alone. You can go to groups and find and talk to men who will innately understand what you're going through. They'll understand your journey, and they will want to share experiences with you and help you learn how to make more informed decisions. Some men can very much struggle with that. Talk about treatment, how to make those decisions, and share what it was like to go through those treatments before you have to. And then they also, very importantly, will share valuable tips that you will not learn from the healthcare professionals. They learn them the hard way, perhaps. And then just knowing that partners are welcome in most support groups. Some might have a separate meeting for them, but most can attend the groups as well. So certainly the benefits of support groups go beyond the medical treatment, of course. You gain so much reassurance from just hearing the stories of others, and you get support along the way. It certainly gives you a safe place to talk about sensitive issues such as sexuality, intimacy issues, and you get real-world advice about recovery and quality of life. One of my favorite gentlemen in the support group, and I've met many through the years, is really great at coming to our meeting, and just informally we'll invite him every once in a while, and he'll talk about very candidly with his issues related to urinary incontinency and sexuality, and he'll bring all of his tips and pads and toys and give us an excellent talk. And then you do get support, as I said, for partners and family members from groups. So the bottom line is these groups really do support you in ways that the medical treatment cannot. So I hope you'll consider coming to a group. A few practical issues about the groups is that they are led by many times volunteers who are prostate cancer survivors who are excellent, have learned to facilitate groups, do fabulous jobs. And then other groups will be run by healthcare professionals, nurses, counselors, social workers, et cetera. You do have a choice. Since COVID, we learned how to do groups virtually, whether we wanted to or not, but it turned out to be a pretty good idea in many instances. We could reach people without them having to fight traffic like in the San Francisco area, or join from other parts of the country, even depending on the group's policy related to that. We also have in-person meetings still. Our group is doing hybrid, so we are trying to be in-person and online, which requires a little bit of technology. There are also groups, as you may know, that are national, regional, local groups. So the good news is that you can decide. Each group will have a little bit different character, a little bit different culture, and so you might attend one group and find that it maybe didn't hit your needs, but another group might. So we would really encourage you to feel free to try different groups, whether it's virtually or in person. And as I said, there are local, national, regional groups. Also, I should mention that there are groups that are focused on caregivers. There might be some that focus on men with advanced prostate cancer or have special sessions for newly diagnosed men. So you will find there might be a little bit different emphasis. So keep that in mind. It's easy to find support groups. We're happy to say online. The Zero website has a search engine for nationally. Not all groups will be listed there, but most of them, many of them are. We also gave you a link for through UCSF, their resource center has for Northern California. And then our, as Merle said earlier, the California Prostate Cancer Coalition website will be up soon again, and I maintain a list for all the groups in California, and there's over 30. So we try to keep that as current as possible. So thank you. I hope you'll consider a support group, and thanks to all the leaders here, past and present. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Nathan Roundy. I'm a prostate cancer survivor, 22 years. I'm currently what I call active surveillance of a recurrence. I have a very slow rising PSA, 7-year doubling time. So I'm not treating it, I'm just watching it. So as Dr. Carroll said earlier today, prostate cancer education is a major component of dealing with prostate cancer. And we have a prostate cancer journal club for patients. This is a new concept, it's never been done before. And the way it works is UCSF group takes the major papers, medical papers, and condenses them down to make it something that a typical prostate cancer patient can understand what the paper has to say. And that is now available online. We have completed 5 of them. You can find them with Google by looking at Prostate Cancer Journal Club for Patients. And that link will find you there. It's also available on the UCSF website, and it's also available on the Euro Today website. So get educated, download the copy of what's been done so far. We do a new one about every quarter, and thank you for your time.
Hi, my name is Lasha Kizdebski. I'm co-chair of Patient Services Committee. Disclosure, I am a permanent lifetime member of Association for Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, so I'm a little biased here on this topic. And while before you heard that maybe sometimes we shouldn't use AI, I want to make case that maybe we should, but carefully, that there are ways to think about it that is very beneficial. There's an amazing proliferation of AI tools at this point. Tools for patients, general tools, tools specific to cancer. There are some tools for doctors. For example, people are using tools to better map cancer cells and extent of the cancer, to better model radiation treatment. There are great AI tools to find prostate cancer cells in the samples, etc. Copilot, which is a Microsoft product, sees over 50 million questions about health on Copilot daily. So use of AI tools is happening. The genie is out of the box. There's nothing we can do to try to put it back in. The best thing we can do is learn how to use it. There was a very interesting study last year at Oxford where they developed 10 different scenarios by doctors, and they loaded them into 3 different general AI tools. And the tools actually were quite amazing. The ability to properly diagnose the case and actually disposition of the case as well, which is, is it emergency, is it treated at home, see your doctor in the future, etc., was extremely accurate. It was anywhere between 90% and 99% accurate. Now, what they did is they gave exactly the same scenarios to almost 1,300 people. They gave them exactly the same tools and ask them to do the same, meaning diagnosis and disposition. The accuracy decreased dramatically. The accuracy was only between 65% and 73%. So it's not the tools, it's how we use the tools that's important. And what I'm trying to do here is try to give you maybe a couple ideas how you can take advantage of those tools, what to look for, and how to really benefit from existence. So first of all, use it to better understand what you get from the doctors. The terminology they use for some of you might be very familiar, but for many of you might be completely, not only unfamiliar, but scary. So using the tool to truly just understand what each term means, what are some potential implications, is really, really a great application of the tool. The next thing is, what are the treatment plans potential? Again, don't necessarily believe that those are the treatments that you should have, you should receive. How to take advantage of it, I'll talk about in a second. And then, instead of just thinking about just this factual learning, ask the tool to suggest how you should talk to your doctor, because ultimately, you need to get ready for your conversation with the doctor. That's the main reason for that use of the AI tool. By the way, there are some great tools also to track symptoms, to notice specific patterns to your symptoms, something that can help you a lot in identifying important things. Now, what works and what doesn't work and how to do that? So first of all, privacy. Maintain your privacy, don't forget about that. Many people just scan your pathology report. If you do that, make sure your social security number doesn't show, your name doesn't show, and a lot of identification data. Then one of the things that, research in Oxford found out was the main reason there were errors was because users were feeding scenarios, elements at the time, versus painting the big picture immediately. So that's one of the things you need to think about. Structure how you're going to position it from the beginning very well to give the full picture as much as possible. One way or the other, you won't be able to do that. So be prepared that some of the information you get back is not 100% accurate. And the last thing, a couple months ago, I was asked to evaluate one of the tools. I was given scenario, and I was asked to use this scenario. I knew that for that particular scenario related to prostate cancer, focal treatment didn't apply. But on purpose, during my interaction with the tool, I decided to ask it, what about focal therapy? Tool said accurately, no, it's probably not a good idea. 5 minutes later, during continuous interaction, all of a sudden said, by the way, ask your doctor about focal treatment. So remember, what you suggest becomes something that tool is going to most likely repeat. Doesn't mean it's the right answer.
Hi, I'm Bruce Zweig. With Leszek, I share the chair for the Patient Services Committee. I'm going to talk about clinical trials and resources you can use to find out about them. Earlier, Carissa Chu showed some really incredibly exciting clinical trials that are available for patients that are going to have surgery, and they're all at UCSF. And a couple of months ago, I was at a conference, and a doctor from England presented a phase one trial result of a drug that combines PSMA and immunotherapy, and it finally worked. I mean, this thing had incredibly great results. And of course, it's going to be 2 or 3 years before this is available and FDA approved. But if you want to get it, you're going to want to be in a clinical trial. His goal, and I'm not making this up, he wanted to treat the cancer without ADT. That's where he's trying to head for. So clinical trials can be pretty good. And so you want to reduce your side effects. You want to get a more powerful treatment, and if you're going to do this, you can ask your doctor to suggest some terms, because you might do some searching on the web that describes succinctly your state and what sorts of trials you may be eligible for. And just a quick thing on these. There's preclinical, which are petri dishes and mice that have been grafted with prostate cancer tumors, and they test them there. And then finally, they're ready for phase one, which is first in human. So the phase one trials are kind of hit or miss, but sometimes they really hit, like that trial that guy talked about a couple of months ago. And then phase two then is a small trial. And phase one, they escalate the dose. So they start with a really safe dose, may not do anything, but at least they know it's safe. And then they keep going until the adverse effects tell them to stop. Phase two then is a small trial. And on a lot of phase two trials, they everybody gets the drug. And so some people think that's maybe a sweet spot for trials. And then finally you get to phase three, where you have like hundreds or thousands of patients in a controlled trial where one group does not get the treatment randomly assigned, and then the other group does. So, and then sometimes at the end, they'll let the group that didn't get it cross over and get it if they progress. But anyhow, some resources. If you want to know what's going on at UCSF, this first one will take you to the UCSF prostate cancer clinical trials, and you'll get a list of 85 of them. Now, the second one is a little harder to use. It's fill in the blank, so you can input keywords. So you'll input prostate cancer, and if there's a particular trial, like you want to do something with prostatectomy or immunotherapy, you can put those in the box, and those trials will come up. And then the last one is the mother of all clinical trial sites. It's called clinicaltrials.gov. And it's every trial in the US and a lot all over the world. Some in China and Japan, India. Anyhow, and that's also keyword selection. And you'll get a lot of trials, and you know, you'll have to spend some time if you want to use that one. So anyhow, I hope you find something that will help you out. Thank you.
Okay, today I'll be speaking about diet and exercise. As I introduced myself earlier, I'm a professor and epidemiologist in urology at UCSF. I've been in the department since 2012. I did my training at Harvard School of Public Health. And thank you for everyone who submitted your questions about diet and exercise. This year we focused on answering your questions in this talk, and so hopefully I will answer your questions, and if you have further questions, please don't hesitate to contact me. So I'm going to start with exercise, because exercise has been the most consistent finding in prostate cancer, and it has the biggest benefit. So if you were to ask me what factor to focus on between exercise and dietary factors, hands down, I would recommend exercise. There have been multiple studies, at least five, looking at exercise in observational studies, cohort studies, among men with prostate cancer. And what we see from studies in Sweden, the United States, and Canada that examined exercise, so higher levels versus lower levels after diagnosis in men with prostate cancer, was a 30 to 40% reduced risk of prostate cancer-specific mortality, and about a 40% reduced risk of overall mortality. And these results are very strong, very consistent, and made it into the U.S. Physical Activity Guidelines in 2018. I led the first study back in 2011, and the last study was published in 2023, and I'm going to just share those results next. I want to highlight that two of these five studies included men at all stages of disease. So this is not just looking at localized prostate cancer, but also men with stage four or metastatic disease. So here are the results from the Lavery study that was published in 2023. This study it was a pan-cancer study, so that means people with various cancers were part of this analysis. So there were over 11,000 cancer survivors, and 4,000 of them had prostate cancer. And this study looked at a cutoff. The cutoff was 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous exercise per week, versus people that were doing less than the cutoff. And again, that is the guideline. The 2018 physical activity guideline is that cutoff of 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous exercise per week. So this study compared people doing more or less than that cutoff. And what you can see is that those who were doing more had a lower risk of cancer death, a 21% lower risk of cancer death, as well as a 25% lower risk of overall death. And I just wanted to highlight this because that provides some rationale for what the cutoff is, 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous aerobic exercise per week. And so if you are not doing that, I recommend starting slow and gradually increasing that over time. My next slide goes over this a little bit. So this slide is part of a paper published by Carrie Winterstone as the senior author. For people to do whatever, to start slow if you're not exercising and to gradually increase that over time. The left-hand column has different categories of activity: inactive, somewhat active, or very regularly active. And if you go across the columns, you can see recommendations for flexibility exercise, aerobic exercise, resistance exercise, and other types of exercise. And the take-home message here is that clinicians can reassure their patients with prostate cancer that exercise of any type, frequency, or duration at tolerable levels of intensity can have a benefit for overall health and well-being. And so we recommend finding exercise that is fun, because we want you to do exercise that you can do repeatedly over time. Finding long-term exercise that is effective and fun. And I know a lot of you, I'm going to talk about exercise opportunities here at UCSF in a few short slides from here. Another study that has been done since that paper came out was published by our group early this year in 2026, led by Ryan et al., Ryan Allen et al., and instead of just emphasizing 1 to 2 sessions per week of resistance exercise, we actually recommend a little bit more, 2 to 3 non-consecutive days per week of resistance exercise. This is because we have published data showing that acute bouts of resistance exercise release myokines, anti-cancer myokines. Myokines are produced by the muscles during exercise, and they have been associated with reduced inflammation. They promote metabolic health and potentially slow prostate cancer growth. And so that is short term, that is short lived. So the more exercise, resistance exercise you do, releases these myokines. So the lead author of this paper, or senior author, Rob Newton, has recommended to do shorter bouts of resistance exercise multiple days per week to get this myokine effect. So we recommend doing at least 2 to 3 resistance exercise sessions, working all major muscle groups, and to alternate between your upper and lower muscles to allow muscle recovery. Okay, this is another slide highlighting the benefits of exercise. How many people in this room do aerobic exercise on a regular basis? Can you raise your hand? Awesome. So at least 80% of you in this room do aerobic exercise. What about resistance exercise? How many people do at least 2 sessions per week of resistance exercise? Okay, I think it's about 40%. So maybe half of you do resistance exercise twice a week. As you can see from the far column in this slide, there are different benefits for each type of exercise. And so with aerobic exercise, this actually increases energy, increases endurance, improves fitness, whereas resistance exercise really builds your muscle mass, it builds your strength, and it also helps with function. And so one should try to do each of these types of exercise is as part of your exercise routine each week. And I'm happy to answer more questions about this. I wanted to highlight opportunities that we offer at UCSF. You may have heard about the Strength in Numbers group exercise class. How many went to the exercise class today? Can I have a raise of hands? Three of you. Okay, 4. Wonderful. So this is a class offered at UCSF by Jordan Lebreck. He's a physical therapist. This occurs twice a week, focusing on aerobic and resistance training. If you have questions about what you should be doing, I recommend you go to this class. You'll learn how to exercise safely and effectively, both aerobically and using resistance exercise. The phone number and the email are located on this slide. And it costs $85 for the initial intake appointment and $20 per class. UCSF also offers exercise counseling for UCSF patients. You can find out more information by calling the number on the slide to sign up. These are offered for free to help people develop a personalized exercise plan for you and to focus on your own physical activity goals. Okay, now I'm gonna switch gears and talk about diet. So diet is a lot more complicated, I think, than exercise. There's been a lot of papers that have come out that some are somewhat conflicting. There are few papers on diet, so I wanna highlight that there are very few factors where we see consistency across the literature. I'm showing this table because, as you know, most men die with their prostate cancer, not of their prostate cancer. Among other causes of death, heart disease is the most common cause of death. And so here we're presenting the recommendations side by side for heart disease prevention, cancer prevention, and lethal prostate cancer progression after diagnosis. And what you can see, so these recommendations come from the American Heart Association for cardiovascular disease progression, the American Cancer Society for Cancer Prevention, and a review paper that we wrote by Longley et al. For prevention of lethal prostate cancer. And what you can see is that the findings, the recommendations, are very similar across the diseases you see in this table. The green check marks are things to do, and the red X's are things to avoid or limit. And what you can see is things are very consistent. What we would say here is that the eating a heart-healthy diet agrees with the recommendations we would give for prostate cancer progression. The findings in the far right column are very specific guidance we would give for those foods that are within that food group. So for example, for fruits and vegetables, we would recommend cooked tomatoes to get the lycopene that's more bioavailable in cooked tomatoes, eating cruciferous vegetables like kale, broccoli, cauliflower, and eating raw vegetables. I got a question about coffee, which is not on the slide, but the data show that coffee is actually beneficial for cardiovascular disease prevention, overall survival. The data for coffee, we published a paper in the CAPTURE cohort, in the diet and lifestyle sub-study of the CAPTURE cohort. We did not see an association for coffee among never smokers or former smokers. However, we did see a fivefold increased risk of progression among current smokers. So I just wanted to highlight that. There was another consortium study looking at coffee intake, but it was measured at the time of diagnosis or slightly before, showing that it may increase disease-specific survival in men with localized prostate cancer. So there aren't very many studies about it, but it does not look like it increases risk. I also got some questions on sugar, so I wanted to address that as well. The current dietary guidelines for Americans came out in 2026 for the period of 2025 to 2030. They were very enlightening. I wanted to just put the added sugar recommendation, which says no amount is recommended as part of a healthy diet. One meal should contain no more than 10 grams of added sugars. The old dietary guidelines for Americans published in 2020 used a cutoff of less than 10% of calories, which is about 50 grams per day on a 2,000 kilocalorie diet. And then I put the American Heart Association guidelines where they have a cutoff of less than or equal to 36 grams per day for men and slightly less grams per day for women. As you can see, I put some examples here of foods that have added sugar. Soda has 39 added grams of sugar. And honey has 17 grams of sugar. And so you will easily get there to the 10 grams by eating some of these foods. So table sugar has 12 grams of sugar, maple sugar has 13, and agave syrup has 14 grams. So you're past the cutoff of 10 grams just by having a tablespoon of these foods. I want to just say, though, that there's no direct evidence of added sugar being related and associated with PSA progression or prostate cancer-specific mortality. These findings are really based on overall metabolic or overall health benefits. Okay, I mentioned before that we published a systematic review by Ryan Allen et al. In our group. We had a table in this paper focused on things to do and things to limit or avoid. And so this table was for clinicians to advise their patients. Today I'm going to show you what we put in that table for all of you to know. First and foremost, we recommend adopting a plant-based eating pattern. And this does not mean that everything you eat must be plants. A plant-based diet is saying that most of what you eat is from plants such as fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts, seeds, etc., and whole grains. You can still incorporate meat, dairy, eggs, and fish and other seafood, but you're eating less of that. They make up a smaller portion of your overall diet. However, a well-planned plant-based diet can provide adequate levels of protein and meet all your essential amino acid requirements. So I have 1 minute. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip ahead. These findings were for overall health. When we looked at diet scores within the systematic review, we saw that limiting processed meat and saturated fat were important for prostate cancer progression. I wanted to highlight that whole milk was one of the more consistent findings in these papers, showing that higher levels of whole milk were associated with either lethal prostate cancer or prostate cancer progression. I got some questions about low-fat dairy. Low-fat dairy has not been consistently associated with prostate cancer progression or with lethal prostate cancer. Some of the findings for advanced disease were really for all-cause mortality. And then only one study showed that total dairy intake with a cutoff of 3 or more servings per day was associated with all-cause mortality. Okay, let me go to this slide. You already heard about calcium. Dr. Friedlander mentioned calcium, getting at least 1,200 milligrams of calcium per day. I got some questions about how do you incorporate calcium if I'm telling you not to eat or drink whole milk? This is a slide that shows different sources of calcium that you can get from your diet, broken into a low-fat dairy category, fortified foods, leafy greens, specifically the kind that with low oxalate, which allows for more calcium absorption, and then other sources like tofu, oranges, other vegetables, almonds and beans, and canned fish. Eggs and prostate cancer. There are two main findings for that. One is about pre-diagnostic egg intake, which is that first bullet, showing an increased risk. I want to focus on the post-diagnostic findings, where you can see no association related to lethal prostate cancer in two cohort studies. We did see an increased risk in the capture cohort, but at levels of 5.5 eggs per week. And so the next level down had no increase, and that was at 3 eggs per week. So we recommend less than 3 eggs per week, which showed no harm. Finally, I'm going to talk a little bit very quickly about protein. This is a slide from Greta McHare, one of our cancer dietitians at UCSF. As you can see, older adults should get at least 1.2 grams per kilogram per day of protein. These are the sources that we recommend for protein, healthy sources of protein that vary from beans and lentils, soy foods, seeds and nuts, fish, low-fat dairy, skinless poultry, and then vegetables and whole grains. This is just to remind me to tell you about our resources on our website. We have guidance for you in all of the different food categories on what to eat. So if you would like to have more information, you can print this out from our website. And finally, free counseling is available to UCSF patients. This can help you answer your cancer-specific questions, help manage nutrition-related side effects of treatment, and also help you decide whether or not to take supplements. Please reach out to your urology practice directly for a referral and to schedule. Our resources are available at this QR code. There's a picture of this in your pamphlet that you got today, so you have this if you picked up one of the brochures. Feel free to reach out to me with any questions. Thank you.
Hi, great presentation. Back over here.
I do have a question about the utility of GLP-1s as they're gaining more traction. And is there any data that is being presented about use that helps patients or helps to decrease, you know, I don't know.
I think your question is about GLP-1s.
Yes,
is that right?
GLP-1s,
okay.
Yes.
It's hard to hear. So far, there are no data on GLP-1s linking GLP-1s to any prostate cancer clinical outcomes. So I think hopefully we'll be able to share something next year about that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So for the egg question, is it the yolk or the whites? Or is it both?
There is choline in the egg white, in the egg yolk, sorry, the egg yolk. But that finding was for pre-diagnosis choline intake. Post-diagnosis choline intake was null. There was no association. So I think it may have to do with choline in the egg yolk, but it's uncertain. I mean, there's only one study now that has showed an increased risk of 5.5 eggs per week.
Okay, thank you.
Does anybody have any thoughts or ideas about THC or CBD in terms of patient and support?
Stan, I can comment a little bit on that. A man in my support group recently asked me that question, and I checked with one of my colleagues who gave me a couple of resources where you can look for providers who do have that type of knowledge. And can perhaps make an appointment with people who are interested to talk to them about the use of those products and do it in a way that would be helpful. So I guess if you wanted to email me, I could pass that information along or somehow get it to whoever the appropriate person is, Dan, whatever you think. I could send those links to you.
Perfect question. Intermittent fasting, any diet, any feedback or thoughts on that?
Again, there's no data on intermittent fasting with clinical outcomes to date. There is an ongoing study, though, of a fasting mimicking diet that is led by Stephen Friedland at Cedars-Sinai. Basically, fasting mimicking diets include reducing your calorie intake for 5 days in a row. So they're looking at a reduction in calorie intake of 700 to 1100 calories for 5 days in a row, and then going back up to regular levels. They're looking at this over 6 months to see if it has any effect on treatment response. So that is an ongoing study. I think it's still enrolling people. Hopefully after they publish this, we'll have more clear data on fasting.
Who was the physician that you referred to?
The PI of that is Stephen Friedland.
Should we avoid cycling as an exercise as it might irritate the prostate?
Cycling, is that what you asked about, cycling?
Cycling.
Irritate the prostate?
Biking. Oh, biking, yeah, biking.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, we do recommend cycling as a viable aerobic activity. I think you have to find something that works for you, because I think it does have negative consequences for some people.
Stan.
Wait, tap.
Hi, your name, but what was the name of the trial that sounded really intriguing that had the successful phase one outcome, so I can look it up?
Yeah, that was called VIR-5500. it has a longer name if you if you want it, but... I don't even know if the results were published. I happened to see it at the conference, but... I've heard that UCSF's going to have a trial with it coming up in a few months. It's offered right now in Seattle, Australia, the UK, and so anyhow.
Can you say what's that? VIR what?
VIR-5500. Like I say, it's only phase one. That's how they do them. They have the company at the beginning. It's VIR technology, and the drug gets a number in these trials.
Okay, looks like one more question.
One more,
right there.
Oh, hi, Martin.
Is there a good resource available to get information on resistant starch?
Sorry, I can't.
What kind of search?
I couldn't hear that.
Is there a good information source for information on resistant starch?
Resistant starch?
Starch.
I am not sure if our booklet covers that, but I can provide more information if it doesn't. I would look in our dietary recommendations booklet that is on our website for that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.